It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 5 to 11-year-olds can now get the COVID-19 vaccine after a decision from federal health officials yesterday. We talked to the head of the State Department of Health Services about the rollout here in Wisconsin. First, if the midterm elections were today, Wisconsin might be electing a new governor and a new U.S. senator. According to yesterday's Marquette University Law School poll, 40% said they'd vote for Democratic Governor Tony Evers, 53% for somebody else. And only 38% said they'd vote for Republican Senator Ron Johnson, 52% said someone else. Among the other highlights, slightly more than half say Wisconsin is going in the wrong direction. About two-thirds say they're very concerned about inflation. 4 in 10 say the same about COVID-19. The poll also got into redistricting, immigration, abortion, and other issues. There's a lot there, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. It's early, but do you plan on voting for Governor Evers? How about Senator Johnson? Are you not sure? Which issues are the most important to you in the state? And as you look ahead to elections, how do you feel about who should draw Wisconsin's legislative maps? How about COVID vaccination mandates? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. He's also co-founder of pollster.com and founder of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, some bad news for key statewide elected offices for both parties here. Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, not getting great results no matter how you slice it, right?
No, I think that's right. I think the things you summarized earlier, sort of the big takeaways, is voters are somewhat grumpy. They're not excited about the direction the state, or for that matter, the country is headed. And it's showing up in Governor Evers' job approval, which is at 45 approve, 46 disapprove. That's the first time he's been underwater on that measure for a while, though it's very close. But that's down from 50 approve in August and 43 disapprove. So there is a notable drop in his approval ratings. Likewise, on the reelect numbers, since it's not at all clear yet who the candidates are going to be, we asked this question in the form of, would you vote to reelect Evers or Johnson, or would you vote for somebody else? So Evers at 40% reelect, Johnson at 38%, both of them over 50% vote for someone else, is showing that they have a base of support that they can probably count on, but that base is well short of 50%. Now, whenever you offer somebody the known incumbent against somebody else, voters can imagine the most wonderful somebody else in the world. And so this is not in any way a projection of where the election would turn out, but it gives us a way of looking at the foundations of support for Evers and Johnson. Both are still holding on to their partisans pretty well and are being massively opposed by the other party. But among independents, they're not doing that well, and that's one of the reasons we see them a little weak on this measure.
Now, I kept scrolling through looking for the person or institution that people in Wisconsin had an overall favorable approval rating for. I keep scrolling all day, right, and not find that.
You could scroll till next month. We asked about 7 different political figures of both parties. And for the first time in 67 polls that we've done, not one of them was more favorable than unfavorable. Now, that ranged from just a little underwater. Tammy Baldwin was at 38 favorable, 39 unfavorable, so just a 1-point difference there, to much more considerable unfavorable balance. Trump at 38 favorable, 57 unfavorable. But it's still striking that that was true of both parties and president, a former president, 2 vice presidents we asked about, and Governor Evers. So really, this is back to the voters are a little grumpy right now, and they're really not enthused at the moment with any of their political leaders.
Right, because a lot of times you might say, oh, Democrats are doing better now and Republicans are doing worse, or Republicans are doing better, Democrats are doing worse. You have you seen this kind of everybody's not looking so pretty? You said it's been a long time or never you've seen everybody underwater like that.
Right. And, you know, part of it is that there's usually been one particular person who's pretty popular. And so that's part of the story. But I think it's surprising that if I told you ahead of time that Tony Evers was at 40% reelect, given the polarization of the state, you might think, well, therefore, Ron Johnson must be at 60% reelect, right? It must be just a partisan split. But instead, we see them both, Evers at 40, Johnson at 38. That's what's telling you that they're not doing that well with independents, because, again, they're both holding on to their bases at least pretty well. But independents are not in a mood to back either of these two incumbents at this point. And again, we have a full year to go. In fact, a good perspective is look back to 2015. Ron Johnson in 2015 had his lowest net favorability ratings in the history of the polling until now, but crept back, getting more and more popular all the way through the 2016 election cycle, and converted a summer trailing in the polls to getting better and better and better, and ultimately beats Russ Feingold in November of 2016. So this is why we keep polling between now and November, but it's also why you want to keep an eye on these things and see how they track over time. Maybe people will get more optimistic about politicians in the country. Maybe they'll get worse. And maybe partisan advantage will start to show up, whereas what we're seeing is both parties seem to be not faring that well, especially with independents.
Talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, about their latest survey of Wisconsin. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Catherine?
Well, I wanted to say I'm 1,000% behind Evers because he is doing his job. And I have to tell you, I'm quite sick of all this early polling. What we need to do is be educating the electorate to be responsible citizens. It's too fickle what you're polling about. And in the time, I mean, I don't care about partisanship and division. I care about issues and concern of the electorate. And this is why the country is in so much trouble. We're focused on media highlighting division, rather than what is our responsibility to our families, to our children, to our country in governing. And the issue for me is we have so many people, Ron Johnson among them, who don't believe in government. And so, but they want to be in these positions to control the people who do.
Catherine, thanks for the call. Charles, we can get into some of the issues you polled on earlier, but what do you think of that idea that reporting these polls in kind of stark terms may reinforce some of our partisan divide?
Well, you'll be surprised to know that as a pollster, I believe polling has a value to contribute. So I'm afraid Catherine and I are not going to agree on that one. I would encourage her and everyone to look at the poll results, because you ran down close to a dozen of the issues we asked about. And I want to stress that this poll has many more questions about public policy issues than it has about horse races. And so it's natural that we start talking about the horse race and about the candidates' favorability and that sort of thing. But we have a lot of questions on here, and, you know, I'm afraid that they're often lost in the conversation. And, you know, the limited amount of time that we have to talk about them. I'd also push back on this point that if we don't have polling, the only people who are going to tell you what the public thinks are going to be the self-interested politicians and interest groups who pay for their own private polling and then talk about it. So, again, in the defense of pollsters here, we're trying our best to give an even-handed look at public opinion that's not coming from parties or politicians or interest groups.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's look at one of the issues you polled on. You asked people, this is a hot topic with the WPR podcast that's sweeping the state mapped out. Redistricting. You asked people what they thought about how we draw the lines that determine who represents what district. What did you find out?
Well, for the third time in 3 years, we find that over 60% would prefer that redistricting be done by a nonpartisan commission. Just 25% think the legislature and governor should do it, and about 15% say they don't know. We've asked this question in 2019, in 2020, and now we've asked it again, and it's been over 60% each time. I think the most striking figure about this, though, is that support for nonpartisan districting is at 62% among Republicans, 63% with independents, and 64% with Democrats. That is a stunningly even distribution of support for nonpartisan districting, regardless of people's partisanship. But it contrasts starkly with the partisan divisions over the actual process of redistricting that we're seeing. The other side of this is that as important as redistricting is, and as much as it's been talked about and as much as activists have been involved with it, only 39% say they're following the process closely or fairly closely, and 60% say not too much or not at all. So the problem of the public not being engaged on the issue is also part of why we don't see any change in the process of districting.
We're finding out how Wisconsin residents feel about key political figures and key issues. Charles Franklin is with us, a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director there of the Marquette University Law School poll. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the job our elected officials are doing in general or particular ones? Is Wisconsin, is the country on the right or wrong track? And which issue do you follow most closely? The economy, COVID, education, immigration, redistricting? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from some more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the latest findings in yesterday's Marquette University Law School poll, asking how Wisconsin voters feel about Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, President Biden, and more, plus issues including immigration, inflation, COVID-19, and more. Charles Franklin is with us, director of that poll. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Torsten is with us in Janesville. Torsten, hi.
Hi. I have a question about that private polling that you were kind of just referencing. I got a call just a couple of days ago asking me if I wanted to do a political survey. And so I started it and everything seemed normal. And then the questions started to skew more and more. And it felt like the questions were trying to influence my answers. And by the end, I asked, you know, where did this poll come from? And said something about the Republican something or other. And it made me wonder, what's the difference between a poll that's being funded by a partisan group like that and a private poll? And how can I know the difference as somebody who's getting the phone call and then how those results are being used in media?
That's a great question. Thank you. There are two ways, or let's say three ways. One is some calls that masquerade as polls are really advertising polls trying to push you, and we call those push polls. I don't think that sounds like what you heard the other day. Campaigns and parties often do what they call message testing within the poll. And in that, they sort of state the best case for that candidate, maybe the worst case against the other candidate, or even they test their own weaknesses and the other guy's strengths, other candidate's strengths. Those are, within the polling profession, seen as perfectly legitimate things to try to ask, because you do want to know how voters react to particular messages or positions. But from the point of view of you as a respondent, it may very much sound like they're trying to influence your opinion, because in a sense they are, to find out what influences you, not that they're really trying to change your position in a permanent way. So it's very, very hard as the innocent respondent at home to know the difference. I will say, to their credit, when you asked who was doing the poll, they apparently gave you at least an indication of it. State law requires people, pollsters, to say who their sponsors are. But for a lot of polls done for political purposes, they'll give you the name of the organization, but it's something nondescript, and no one would know who that is and who they're working for. And that's a problem, I think. For nonpartisan polls, media polls, or university polls like mine, the very first things we say when we call is, I'm calling on behalf of Marquette University. And so you know right up front that it's us calling. But if you're a campaign, you don't want to call and say, I'm calling on behalf of the Evers campaign or on behalf of the Johnson campaign, because that could obviously skew your results. So this is a problem with polling and what is revealed to the respondent and what's not.
Torsten, thanks for the call. Going out to John in Luck. John, hello.
Hello. Hello.
Yep. What'd you want to bring up, John?
Well, I'm of an age where I remember the silent majority, and I'm wondering about either the Republicans or the Democrats if these negative numbers at 38% really just reflect the base, the bases that have solidified, and in this case, high negatives, and what is driving the outcomes are what we used to call in the old days the silent majority, who may be moving, because the results, not only in Wisconsin but in the Virginia and New Jersey, for example, on Tuesday, there was a massive swing, and it sounds to me like it's those people that the pollsters don't get, or who are independent, and we don't hear about them as much.
John, thanks. The silent majority, the thought that, hey, maybe there are some people out there that we aren't measuring well enough who surprise us on Election Day, Charles.
No, I think that's a good point. And, you know, pointing to Virginia and New Jersey is a terrific point, because Biden won those states pretty handily by 6 or 7, I think, in Virginia, by 16 or so in New Jersey. And you get, you know, swings of 7 to maybe as much as 15 or so percent in those two. That is a great example that looking at the last election and believing this election will be just like that is really wrong. What we have in our data is about 40% who say they're independents, though of those, only about 9% say they're independent and don't lean towards either party. But that 9% can be a critical balance in a state that's divided, in our data, again, 30% Republican to 29% Democratic. We're right on the knife's edge there. And so 9% can make a difference. If you also look at those people that are independents and lean to a party, most of the time they vote with that party. That's true. But they don't vote as loyally as pure partisans. So in one sense, their votes are up for grabs, too. It's just that maybe among that group, they only go 75% with the party they lean to instead of 85% with that party. But there, again, is enough movement to make a difference. And in Wisconsin, 4 of the last 6 presidential races were decided by under a single percentage point. The governor's race was decided by 1.1 percentage points in 2018. So I think there's lots of room for swing at the margin. And then finally, there's the thing of turnout. A mobilized electorate can make up for a lot if the mobilization is on one side.
Thanks for that call. I want to check out a couple more issues before we run out of time. One, concern about inflation. What did you find out when you asked people about that?
Inflation concern is quite high and getting higher. 64% said they were very concerned about it, and another 28% somewhat concerned. So that puts us up to 92% significantly concerned. And that's up from August when it was 49% very concerned. So this is an issue that hasn't been before us for really several decades. But now it's back, and it is definitely getting the public's attention. An obvious question is how long it continues to see significant inflation. And inflation of all the economic issues is the one that every citizen experiences when they fill up their gas tank or go to the grocery store or buy their kids' clothes. So it can be a potent issue, and right now it's one with really a lot of concern in the public.
And the U.S. Supreme Court hearing an abortion case earlier this week, another one coming up next month. You asked about abortion briefly, and just our last, we've got a minute. What did you find out?
61% say abortion should be legal in most or all situations. 34% say it should be illegal in most or all cases. We've asked this question 11 different times since 2012, and it hasn't moved by more than a couple of percentage points from poll to poll, with no trend up or down for either side of the abortion issue.
And, just a few moments left. How about immigration?
Immigration concern, illegal immigration, has risen slightly. It's at 43%, very concerned, up from 37 in August, well behind inflation, but still pretty significant. And concern about COVID is at 40%, very concerned. So there you see the pandemic maybe dropping behind these other two issues as top concerns for the public.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We talked to him about the survey that came out yesterday. It shows only about 40% of registered voters would vote to reelect Governor Evers, they say, and just 38% say that about Senator Johnson. Coming up after the news, the head of the State Department of Health Services joins us to talk about COVID vaccines for kids, booster shots, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cigarette sales went up last year for the first time in decades. We'll look at some of the potential reasons for that increase and what it means for our health. Now, millions of 5 to 11-year-olds in the U.S. can now get vaccinated against COVID-19. That's after the federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gave the final all clear this week. And limited booster shots for the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines have been underway for almost 2 weeks in Wisconsin. We're checking in on both of those stories and more with the state's top public health official. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you planning to get your newly eligible 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated? How are you talking to your kids about the vaccine? What questions do you have about the availability of vaccines for kids and booster shots? How it is all working in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Timberlake is the Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Secretary Designee Timberlake, thanks for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into those vaccines and how available they are, big picture, can you talk about the state of COVID-19 here in Wisconsin?
Sure. So I think there's sort of a good news story and a reason to stay vigilant, as one of my colleagues said the other day. The good news is, as compared to the real spike in positive cases that we saw earlier this fall, we have seen a bit of a decline in our average case count day after day and week after week. So that's good. That said, the current rate of positive cases is still pretty comparable to what it was back in the sort of early part of the year, back in the winter, in January or so. really wide-scale rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines. And so we also know that we have to stay vigilant in terms of making sure that everybody who's eligible to get vaccinated gets vaccinated, making sure that folks who are feeling symptomatic or know that they've been exposed to someone with COVID-19 are getting tested so that we can find and address those cases right away. Making sure folks who are not feeling well stay home when they're sick. And now is a good time also to underscore that it is time to get a flu shot because seasonal influenza will be here before we want it to be. And that also creates a challenge, certainly for our hospitals and our healthcare capacity.
All right, now turning to a vaccine for kids. As I understand it, kids in Wisconsin age 5 to 11 have started getting vaccines today. Can you talk about what you're seeing in the rollout?
Absolutely. So really good news that this week we got the final approval from the CDC for the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11. So this is under an emergency use authorization. I think folks who have been following the rollout of the COVID vaccines in general know that this is kind of the first phase of access to one of the COVID vaccines. Starts under an emergency use authorization from the FDA, which again relies on a great deal of clinical trial data and other careful analysis of both the safety and the effectiveness of the vaccine. So now we have vaccinators all across the state. So that may be our pediatric clinics, that can be some local public health clinics that are partnering with schools. Our pharmacies around the state have announced that they're starting to administer vaccines for kids ages 5 to 11. And so we're adding those points of access for the COVID-19 vaccine for those younger children to what is already available for kids ages 12 and up, and of course, all adults. So it's really a great expansion of the ability of parents and families to protect their younger children ages 5 to 11 from being infected with COVID-19.
And I happened to call a health clinic yesterday for an unrelated reason and got a message saying, yeah, we're getting lots of calls because of this COVID for kids, roll out the booster shots. If people are running into what look like log jams, what do you suggest to them as they're seeking vaccines for those 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yep, great question. And honestly, from a public health perspective, I'm really pleasantly surprised and pleased to hear that you're hearing reports of that kind of demand already. That's really good news. You know, a couple of ways for people to access information about the vaccine. One is to go to vaccines.gov, which continues to be just a great repository of information as far as where the COVID-19 vaccines are available and instructions about how to sign up and make an appointment. Another option, of course, is to check as you did with your own healthcare provider. So in the case of parents and family members with younger children, that's your pediatrician's office, that's your family doctor, that's your community health center, if that's where you get your care. They will have information, whether it's over the phone or many of them on their websites, about vaccine availability, how to book an appointment. Another good option for people is the 211 system. So simply calling 211 connects you to a real person who can talk you through how to find out more about where vaccines are available. But, you know, I think as we have learned with the rollout of vaccines all throughout the pandemic, there is a lot of demand early on that can create a little bit of delay. We just would ask for people to be patient and to know that the really good news is that there is enough Pfizer vaccine available for kids ages 5 to 11 across the country. It just will take a little bit of time for those waves of doses to get distributed around the country. So again, vaccine is here in the state and available for those younger kids. And if you don't get the very first appointment time that you're interested in, keep checking and one will certainly be available.
We're talking to Karen Timberlake, head of the state's Health Services Department, looking at COVID-19 vaccines for kids. We'll get into booster vaccines and public health officials leaving their posts. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on any of those topics at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Heather is with us in Franklin. Heather, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Heather?
Well, I know that, and she touched a little bit on it as far as authorization as opposed to approval. Even the 12 to 15 year olds, it's still in like the authorization period. How long does it usually take to get that approval?
Heather, thanks for that call. So again, that's the emergency use authorization versus the longer process of getting the full approval. What is the kind of time frame that people are watching for?
Right. Maybe the best way I can answer that is let's remember what happened for the COVID vaccines for people ages 16 and up. So when these vaccines first became available back at the end of calendar year 2020, so it was back in December that the first COVID vaccines were actually available, again, for everybody under emergency use authorization. And I want to say that it was in the late summer to maybe very early fall. Don't hold me to that. We can certainly get you the actual date. Mm-hmm. But it was a matter of perhaps 6 to 9 months later that the vaccines moved from emergency use authorization onto that full FDA approval status. And so, you know, I think the thing that's important for people to understand and what I think really does underlie that really good question is, sort of why do we start with an emergency use authorization as compared to that sort of full FDA approval? And so the thing for people to understand is that there is a great deal of rigorous research and evaluation of these vaccines in the groups of people that they are designed for that occurs long before we even get to this emergency use authorization stage. So what that means is, in the case of the vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11, it has been tested in clinical trials involving tens of thousands of kids ages 5 to 11, and it has been deemed safe and effective in those kids. And so it is viewed as safe and effective enough to be out and available on the market, and there are sort of remaining regulatory processes that need to be gone through to move it from that emergency use authorization over to full approval. But folks really should have confidence in the research and the rigorous safety validation that occurs before any one of these vaccines for any of us even makes it into a pharmacy or a doctor's office.
Heather, thanks for that call. Secretary Timberlake, parents of these 5 to 11-year-olds, I know some are excited to get the vaccine as soon as possible. Others might say, hey, you know, COVID-19, much more dangerous for older people. The rates of bad outcomes for younger people are much, much lower. Not completely safe, of course, but much lower. What is the case for recommending the vaccine, as your department is, for the 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yeah, you bet. So such a great question. And this is really one of the most challenging things about the whole COVID-19 pandemic is that each one of us is making that kind of risk benefit calculation every day with whether we choose to, you know, have a big group of people over together inside our house versus out in the backyard, what kinds of other activities we decide to engage in. And when it comes to the vaccine, you know, I guess I would make a couple of points when it comes to kids ages 5 to 11. First, it is certainly true that younger children in general do not get as sick as older people do when it comes to being exposed to COVID-19. That said, they certainly do get sick, and when they get sick, they can end up missing school and missing other kinds of activities. And one of the things we know for our younger kids is, and frankly, older teens as well, is there's just been a lot of disruption of school and activities, extracurriculars, things that kids really count on as part of their day-to-day, week-to-week experiences. And we want to minimize those disruptions to the greatest extent that we can. We also know that, again, even though most children don't get all that sick, some children do. And we have had more than 1,600 young people under the age of 20, so a little bit broader than just the 5 to 11-year-olds that we're talking about, but 1,600 younger people in hospitals in our state just since March of last year with COVID-19. And for anyone who's had a child with a complex or a serious health condition who has needed hospitalization, that's a terrifying experience for a family and really a scary experience for that child, as good as our hospital care is. So that is something that I think parents want and guardians want to avoid at all costs. And we also know, of course, that kids live in families and in communities, and they are interacting with their aunts and uncles, their grandparents, older adults in their lives. And so kids can also be transmitters of COVID-19. And we want, at the end of the day, we want to protect everyone all across our state from this disease and put this pandemic in the rearview mirror. So all of those things are reasons that we really do recommend, and the American Academy of Pediatrics really recommends, that every child age 5 and up get vaccinated against COVID-19.
We're talking to Karen Timberlake, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, with us today for a look at COVID-19 vaccines for kids, booster shots, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you getting an appointment for your 5 to 11-year-old? Have you gotten it yet? How about booster shots? Are you seeking one? Have you gotten one? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the latest on the fight against COVID-19, including vaccines for kids. Secretary Designee Karen Timberlake is with us from the State Department of Health Services. Go back to your calls now with Cindy in Green Bay. Cindy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My daughter turns 12 in December, early December. Do we get the 11-year-old dose now and get her fully vaccinated? Or do we wait until she turns 12 and get the greater dose?
Yep, that is just a great question, and I know it has come up recently. The clinical guidance is that kids should get the vaccine that is appropriate for the age that they are when they get vaccinated. So for an 11-year-old, they should get the dose, and I believe it's a 1/3 the amount that is given to older kids. So 11-year-olds get that dose today. If that child turns 12 by the time it's 3 weeks later and time for them to get their second dose, then they would get the dose that's suitable for 12-year-olds. So that's what the clinicians are telling us. And so that's what our vaccinators are being instructed to do.
Cindy, good luck figuring that out. Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mark in Elgin, Illinois. Mark, hi.
Hi. Love the show. And I just called. I got my booster I've had no side effects. My own children have equally been vaccinated. I have no concerns. I was mentioning to your screener there also, too, I admire the prowess of Mr. Rogers, the quarterback, but apparently he is not an epidemiologist, and I wish he would have the intelligence to realize that there are certain things he doesn't know, but epidemiologists do.
I gotcha, Mark. Thanks for the call. That's a whole nother conversation. But he mentioned those booster shots, Secretary Timberlake. Can you talk about the current guidelines for who should be seeking out those boosters or at least thinking about it?
Yep, absolutely. So for people who received the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine as their primary vaccine, once 6 months have elapsed, there are groups of people who are really strongly encouraged to go ahead and get a booster dose. And it's a long list, but I'll try to be quick. So it's everyone 65 years and older, because we continue to see that that is the age group that is most susceptible to really serious complications and death from COVID-19. Anyone living in a long-term care setting, people who are 18 and older who have a long list of complex or chronic health conditions, cancer, potentially diabetes, HIV infection, even smokers, people whose underlying health status puts them at greater risk. In addition, people over the age of 18 who work in settings where they're interacting all day, every day with members of the general public. So first responders, teachers, people working in manufacturing settings, not so much maybe because of the general public, but because they're working in close quarters with one another, grocery store workers, right? So all of those folks, Pfizer and Moderna, after 6 months, 6 months after completing that primary vaccination series, they would be eligible for boosters and really should go get them. In the case of Johnson & Johnson, it's a little bit simpler. So essentially everyone who got a Johnson & Johnson shot initially should get a booster dose at least 2 months after they got that first Johnson & Johnson dose. And as I'm sure your listeners are following, the advice for people who got Johnson & Johnson is that they can be boosted with Johnson & Johnson, or they could choose to be boosted with a Pfizer or a Moderna vaccine.
Thanks again for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Austin next in Barron. Austin, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I have a question. I have two sons, a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. And we've always been getting all the vaccines that we're supposed to since they've been born. And my parents are telling us not to get it and to hold off because of the emergency use. They're saying it's not approved yet. And my concern is that if they do have some sort of reaction or something, since it's under the emergency use, is there some sort of recourse as far as if they have, you know, anything that could go wrong with them health-wise? Is Pfizer liable for that? Or since it's an EU approval, does that mean that they're not liable for that?
Austin, thanks for the call. Is that something you've been following, Secretary Timberlake?
Yeah, so I definitely don't feel like I'm ready to give advice on the potential for sort of liability issues. What I can say is that these vaccines have been given now hundreds of millions of times across the country, certainly in the 12 and up age group. And as I noted previously, just really rigorous testing in the younger age group. I think the other thing to remember is that we're talking about the same vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine itself, that has been fully approved for people ages 16 and up. And so, you know, that's also, I think, a good note of reassurance that the safety profile is really strong. And certainly the group of scientific advisors and experts that took a look at the clinical trial data before approving the vaccine for kids 12 to 15 and looked at it for kids 5 to 11. You know, in the case of 5 to 11-year-olds this week, it got a unanimous endorsement from that group of advisors who are really studying the data. And the last thing to say on that question is certainly parents and guardians and family members are going to have questions about the vaccine. And the best place to start is with your own care provider, your family doctor, your child's pediatrician. Call them up and have a conversation about what makes sense for your child and your family.
Thanks for that call. I want to take a couple minutes before we let you go to check out another issue I'm sure you're paying attention to. A lot of public health turnover, local health departments losing their leadership, a high-stress year and a half here, a lot of public pressure in some cases. What do you make of that level of turnover and the impact it could have?
So what I want to say, first of all, is we throughout the course of this pandemic have just relied so heavily on our local public health departments, our public health directors, their staff, to be on the front lines of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, folks may not really understand what local public health departments have been doing when it comes to COVID-19. So these are the folks, you know, when there are cases that break out in a place of employment or a school or a long-term care setting, they're going in to do the investigations, do the contact tracing, see what they can do to contain the outbreak right away. They are doing a lot of proactive consulting with employers and schools to make sure people can be safe. They're running vaccination clinics and community testing programs. And that's on top of doing everything that they do all across our state to keep our restaurants and our food supply safe, make sure we've got good water quality, good air quality. So a huge part of our ability to be healthy and safe in everything we do in Wisconsin relies on our local public health leaders. So we owe them just a huge thank you. It has been a stressful year. We are certainly wanting to make sure that we continue to provide the kind of investment in resources that we know our local public health leaders need. Governor Evers has announced about $58 million in funding to continue to infuse into local public health departments on top of about $106 million that was previously allocated. So at the end of the day, you know, I think we all need to, as people have noted, give each other some patience and some grace and recognize that we really are all in this together and working together, doing the best that we can to keep one another safe. We will get through this pandemic.
Secretary Timberlake, thanks again for joining us today.
You are very welcome.
That's Karen Timberlake, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She was with us today to talk about the rollout of vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds here in the state, along with the latest on booster shots and more. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call joins the program for a look at election review efforts, redistricting, and other legal issues facing Wisconsin. And as always, you can join in with your own questions and comments for the state's attorney general. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Milwaukee could go all the way in an online competition to pick the best city in the United States. The competition is about as scientific as it gets. It's a bracket tournament on Twitter set up by some guy on the internet, an urban planning expert named Nolan Gray. 64 cities started off the bracket. Milwaukee has been on a winning streak. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, voters selected number 10 seed Milwaukee over number 7 Austin, Texas in the opening round. Since then, Milwaukee has beaten Miami, San Francisco, and Minneapolis. That led to an I-94 showdown with Chicago in the semifinals. Milwaukee narrowly pulled out the win. And now start spreading the news because Milwaukee is in the finals against New York City.
New York City.
Hey, if we can make it there, we can make it anywhere. You can find the poll at the Twitter handle at MNolanGray. Looks like voting hasn't started yet. First the Bucks, now this. This is Central Time.